In today's day and age, this digital revolution that we're going through, what we find is there's uncertainty all across the organization. And so everybody needs entrepreneurial skills. They don't all apply it to the same degree.
Hello, and welcome to BrandTuned, the only podcast on branding that covers IP, which is intrinsic to business and brands. I'm Shireen Smith, lawyer, brand strategist, and curious business owner, keen to discover the secrets of effective brand building to create a successful business. My guest today is Brant Cooper, best-selling author of The Lean Entrepreneur, which is a New York Times bestseller. He is also CEO of Moves the Needle. Welcome, Brant. Hello.
Hi, Shireen. Thanks for having me. So Moves the Needle teaches entrepreneurial spirit to very large enterprises. So I have a background in startups, lived through the dot-com boom and bust up in the San Francisco area, and ended up writing several books on lean startup type principles and leading to the lean entrepreneur. And so then we launched Moves the Needle to take that to very large organizations that don't tend to be very entrepreneurial.
Oh, right. So it's when they've got new initiatives for intrapreneurs, is it?
Right. So initially, at least, we thought that, okay, this is for the innovation groups or the intrapreneurs inside these large enterprises. In today's day and age, this digital revolution that we're going through, what we find is there's uncertainty all across the organization. And so everybody needs entrepreneurial skills. They don't all apply it to the same degree. But the entrepreneurial skills are ones, whenever you face uncertainty, you have to be in learning mode instead of just execution mode. And so that's sort of what we teach, is this entrepreneurial spirit that you use when you need to learn instead of just execute on the existing plan.
So when did you start this business?
Started it in 2014. And we've worked with over 60 large enterprises all around the world.
So how did you get your first client?
I haven't written the book. We actually had clients during that whole process. So I had previously written a book back in 2010 called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Customer Development, which was the first book that talked about lean startup and customer development and product market fit and those type of things. And so among a limited sort of startup-y crowd, I was already known and would get, sort of more startup-y clients. When Eric Ries published The Lean Startup, he kind of blew the top off the market. And so corporations became interested in that. So then as I was writing The Lean Entrepreneur, we were just knocking on doors and we had inbound calls and we found a couple of companies, Capital One and American Airlines and Microsoft, who actually sponsored our book tour. And so that was probably the beginning of the work. Though I also remember we did work with 7-Eleven and we did it for free. And so that's sort of, we did the workshops for free. And that's, in the startup world, that was always one of those ways that you would get in the door of large corporations, is that you would not charge them very money for, the first version of something, just so they would, help kick the tires and help validate that you were doing something of value.
Oh, that's interesting. So what were the challenges initially of starting in this area? I mean, what was your background before that led to
this? I think the background was all, the startup-y stuff. And so big companies were naturally intrigued by that because, they realized, especially coming out of the Great Recession, companies were struggling. And again, they're struggling again during the pandemic. So I guess I didn't do a great job over the last 6 years. But I think that the struggles with the large companies is that they know that they're not customer-centric enough. And they know that they're not agile in the sense they can't take in new information from the world and change what they're doing. And they just move too slowly. And so that's what their challenges were. Our challenges were really trying to find how do we change the mindset. And for the people that would go through our workshop, they would love to work this way. They love working in an entrepreneurial way. It's creative, and people are inspired to work that way. They get to try to solve problems. And I think that that's what smart people love to do. Our challenge was always trying to get that sticky, to try to spread that mindset, to try to get leaders to buy in so that they would do it on a larger scale. And out of those 60 companies, only a handful went for any sort of significant mindset change.
Is this when they're developing new products, launching new products to understand what the market needs?
I mean, yes, we... Right. You know, being a services company, it's pretty easy for us to run experiments, and which running experiments is, you know, sort of the dog food that we eat. That's part of what we teach. And so hopefully that's partly what we do. So being engaged at some level with these customers means that we can understand more specifically, we can understand better what their needs are, and then we can develop services and give them a try and see if they actually work and if they provide more value. So we started off with these workshops that would go 2 or 3 days. And then we ended up developing our own sprint, really, which was more of a 5-day workshop. And then we added leadership components. And then we added accelerator programs. So doing really more digital transformation projects that would be run in 90-day cohorts. And so really continued to evolve a portfolio of services in order to try to drive that bigger impact inside these organizations.
So what sort of sizes are your accelerators? How many people come? Are they from the same company or different
ones?
Yeah,
they're all from the same company. We did one over the summer completely remotely, which was the first time we did that. That was crazy. But we had 7 teams of 10 people, all on using, you know, the Google video service, which wasn't ideal either because they don't have breakout rooms. And so it was actually pretty complicated, but we accomplished an amazing amount in 90 days.
So what was wrong with using Zoom as a matter of interest?
Well, that's part of Google's or Zoom's problem is competing against large tech monopolies. And so this company was a Google house, and Google offered their video services for free for those people that were already paying for Google Suite. And so rather than pay Zoom more money, they got their free video service through Google.
Okay, so you've got a suite of different programs to help companies to think like a startup.
That's right, exactly right.
And do you discuss brand with them at all? Because a lot of essentially brand strategy does involve understanding your customers.
Yes. So we've done specific work with marketing teams inside, not a ton, but inside a few of these enterprise customers, we've done specific versions of our workshops or sprints around developing, you know, brand changes. We wrote a book called The Lean Brand, sort of our take on how to apply these lean innovation principles to the marketing and brand world. Interestingly, we also talk about when we're successfully launching an innovation program inside of a company and they want to scale it company-wide, we talk about internal branding for that program, which is really kind of a fascinating subject inside of large enterprises, because whenever they're taking on initiatives, which is often led by, I don't know, human resources, they have to brand those things internally. And I'm not sure they actually get the right people involved in that project. You know, it can sink or swim, you know, it can make the project sink or swim. So I think that's interesting, and it's part of one of the things that we counsel is how to brand these programs. So I think that's kind of interesting. But yes, we've also done the external customer-facing side of branding for a handful of companies.
So how about your own company? How did you initially brand your company when you were setting
up? Well, so we were lucky to have a really sharp designer as one of our early co-founders. He ended up dropping out, but he was super talented. And so he chose our colors, and he developed the logo, and he just really gave us a solid feel, I think, that was who we were. I think we didn't really go through any of the traditional branding exercises that you hear about. I was a marketing guy for a while in my startups, and so I've been through that. I sort of understand branding to a certain degree. I'm no expert like yourself, but a lot of that stuff I feel is not, at least from the brand artifact side, a lot of that stuff is not that important at the beginning. And a matter of fact, I think startups can overemphasize that. And they can actually spend a lot of time and money and resources that it's wasted over developing that. And if you look at a lot of the successful startups in the world, and you can use like the Wayback Machine, you can see how bad it was at the beginning. And so I think that we were lucky that we had a guy that could make us look pretty good and everybody thought we were bigger than we actually were. And so I think that was probably sort of a success factor or a success indicator.
Yeah, for sure. It's actually often necessary to spend a few years testing the market, seeing what the market responds to. So it's definitely not worth spending a lot on branding in those days.
Well, and really startups don't even know who their customer is, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of one of these things where often young entrepreneurs getting advice from people, you know, the first people they get plugged into are lawyers and marketers, and they could spend a lot of money on both without actually even understanding what their business is yet.
Yeah, I mean, I actually often advise people to choose, well, the sort of name you've got is what I'd call a descriptive name. It's, you can't really own that, moves
That's
the
right.
needle. So that's a very good type of name to get up and running, because you don't really need to then spend on trademarking or all those things that add expense. Subsequently, when you've really taken off, and if you want to, you can then find a name and maybe use what you initially started with as a tagline or something. So there are strategies for minimizing expenses, I guess, when you first start.
Well, that's great. I guess we were just lucky in that regard. I'm sort of the creative guy when it comes to words. And and I liked it. It's a little bit cliche, I guess. And experts have told me that, yeah, if you're really super successful, you're going to want to rebrand. And I was all like, yeah, you're probably right, but this will do for now. And I just absolutely love it, to be honest. When my clients or potentially clients use the name of my company in a conversation with me, not referring to the company, because then they always kind of look sideways at me and chuckle because they see what I'm up to. So that always amuses me.
So what's your process? How do you help companies with, say, working out their customers?
So we're big on personas. I think that different than maybe some old school market research type of stuff, we're really more focused in the innovation world on narrow focused. We want to actually find our early adopters. And so we're not trying to go broad or wide. We actually want to go super narrow and try to figure out, well, what is the pattern? What are the characteristics? What are the behaviors of a group of people that share the same need or passion or desire, and then I say, and speak the same language so that they would refer to each other for solutions that address a need. And so when we talk about personas, we really want them to describe a real person and think about, well, where did those people hang out? And then go and find them and try to validate that those characteristics and behaviors really do describe this group of people. I find that entrepreneurs, and that actually it's in big companies too, it's the reasons are a little bit different. The startups, they want a million customers because that's how they're going to be wildly successful. And so it's really difficult to get them to think about, you know, what's the pattern of individuals that's going to spend the night in the parking lot outside of the store because they want to be the first ones to grab your product. And for the large companies, it's difficult because they already have a million customers. And so they want to do something new that will tackle all of those million customers. And it's just, in my view, not how you can start discovering or validating this value that you want to bring to a market. You have to find there. I tell this story all the time, but there was an entrepreneur I was helping in Madison, and he had this app that you choose an article of clothing and then you'd hit a shuffle button and it would finish the wardrobe. And I'm all like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. So, you know, what's your problem? How can I help you? And he said, I need 1,000 customers. And I said, well, how many do you have? And he said, 0. And I said, you don't need 1,000. You need 1. Go find 1 person who's willing to push that shuffle button. You know, go out into the streets and see if you can interest anybody. And so I think, yeah, so that's how I think about, you know, going out and discovering customers. We love creating personas that try to describe who these different market segments might be. And then you go out in the real world and try to validate that you've got the right people and they've got the need that you think they have, and that, you know, the idea that you have to address their need is interesting to them at all.
So you've got a product. Would it be a tech product idea that somebody might have?
Well, so that's
for which they're looking for customers.
Yep, could be a tech product. It's not always a tech product. We've done manufacturing, selling to businesses. We've done chemical companies. We've done medical device companies, banking companies, insurance companies. So sometimes it's tech. Sometimes it's tech inside of those type of companies I just described. Tech is in almost everything. We've done, you know, CPG though. I mean, so it's all industries because we all face uncertainty. And so we don't have to be an expert in the industry. We're just experts in applying these concepts to help people discover the value that they can bring to their customers.
Have you read Clayton Christensen's Jobs to be Done?
I have not read his Jobs to be Done. There's a guy up in the Bay Area who actually interviewed with Clayton Christensen. Clayton got some of his ideas from this guy. The company is called, what is it? Oh, man, it's totally blanking. I'll come back to it. This guy does a Jobs to be Done, outcome-driven innovation, and I really like it. It's well done. I think that there's, like a lot of these things, I think they're hard to put into practice in a strong way, but I think that the idea is solid.
Yeah, the idea that somebody's got a goal that they're trying to achieve, and if you understand that goal, then matching customers to the goal that your product might achieve,
yes,
will more likely hit the nail on the head rather than trying to create a product to meet lots of needs.
So the name of the company is Stratagen up in the Bay Area. It's Tony Olwick. And so he's uh-huh. got interesting ideas around that. I think that the trap in the Jobs to be Done can be that you think of the job, but you haven't thought of the context of the job well enough. Sort of this upstream or downstream from the actual job that your product is going to resolve. The context matters a lot. So, you know, there's a common way people describe this is that, you know, nobody wants to own a drill or a drill bit. They want a hole. Right.
Sure.
And so I go, well, nobody actually wants a hole. What they want is to hang something, or they want to, you know, they're doing surgery and they're trying to repair a ligament in the knee. Right. You actually drill a hole. And so when you start thinking about the different holes and the reason why people are drilling the hole, now you're starting to get to the real job. And then it matters who's drilling the hole, right? My daughter goes to college and she wants to hang a flat screen TV on the wall of her apartment and has never done any of that before in her life. Her experience with drilling holes is going to be way different than a carpenter. And so if you're a Home Depot or a drill manufacturer and you understand that context, the way you're going to market and sell and provide support is going to be, you know, way different. So I think it's great to start with the job and then you sort of pull back and look at these larger the larger context that can then influence how you're going to reach out to them and present your solution to them.
Yeah. And then you get into positioning, because apparently these very big companies can own a particular sort of position in the market, like Volvo owns safety. So there are hundreds of different types of car, but if they own safety, and in the same way, drills, presumably you can own lots of different positions in the market. I just wonder if you go into it with in that way as well or not.
Typically, we're not getting that deep. We have done, again, we've done some of that work. We've actually used some of the jobs to be done principles in that way. Companies that are very technical companies, you could even include like the CPG companies, but companies like Procter & Gamble and 3M and WD-40 and these companies that were founded based upon, you know, pretty technical products, science, they often need to go and search the market for needs that they can address with the chemicals that they've already created, the products that they've created out of those chemicals. And so then that becomes interesting because you have to go and find those jobs. You have to go find those needs. And then you look, they typically look at their own brand and they kind of go, well, does that fit into our existing brand? Or would we have to go and launch something completely new? And that ends up being really a really big decision, right? Whether you're going to be able to fit a new product underneath your existing umbrella, or do you have to create something, you know, completely new?
So do you help your customers to interview people, or do you just teach them how to go about doing it? Do you actually do the interview?
Yeah, we've gone along with them before, but we don't do the work. Really, we're trying to build capabilities. That may have been a business model mistake on my part, to be honest, because I think like during the downturns, those companies that actually do the work have survived better than those of us that teach the work.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I'm finding. I guess if I could put everything online, people would be, maybe that would work, but I've never found that to work, to be honest. But I just think for companies to thrive and survive in the 21st century, they need to learn the capabilities that are not going to be able to outsource understanding their customers.
Okay, so from what you've just said, I gather you don't do any online programs, like online courses supplemented with coaching. You just do what, public speaking and then these workshops?
Yeah, I've got a separate side business where I have created videos and templates. It's not a formal course, but startupbluebook.com for entrepreneurs and startups mostly. That's a way to get access to like my persona tools and a couple of videos on how to use them. I haven't pushed that real hard because I'm sort of really knee deep in my next book. That's what I'm focused on.
All right. What is it?
Tentatively titled Disruption for All. It's more of a leadership book than my past, which was more tactical. And it really is trying to help large corporations reinvent their businesses for the 21st century. I think that many of them have lost their way in terms of not focusing on creating value for customers. They're too concentrated on creating wealth for shareholders rather than, you know, really trying to understand their customers again. And so using a lot of the methods that I've talked about, but really from a leadership perspective to get that mindset change, I think a lot of the imbalances that we're seeing in the world could be helped by companies going back to their roots and that entrepreneurial spirit again, and really trying to create value for human beings.
Yeah, it must be very difficult for a large organization to turn around and start adopting an entrepreneurial mindset.
Yep, yet they were all founded that way. That's the they've all got that
100 years ago.
Yeah. Some of them not even that old, but yeah, you're right. It is tough, but they're all kind of talking about it. They all kind of know they need to do it. And so I think that and really, you know, there's a lot of great leadership books out there. Brené Brown's Dare to Lead and General Stanley McChrystal's Team of Teams. And I there's just so much leadership guidance out there now. And I think it's all great. I just don't think that they have the programs to apply it. And so I think that there's some glue there that I can provide where if you do these things, you're applying those new skills, and this is how you're going to hopefully, you know, scale that new mindset. There are examples of companies successfully changing, and so I think they can do it.
So will you go and train them so that they can then train other people? How would you develop that?
Yeah, so I don't know what my business model is going to be afterwards. You know, I think that I don't really want to at this point build up a big company again. Big. I mean, we got up to 18 people at one point, so it was not exactly big. So but if people want the sort of help from me or my team, then, you know, we will definitely build it up. It just probably won't be me running it, to be honest.
So you prefer to have a lifestyle business and rather than to grow into a sort of mega big business?
At this point, yes. I mean, I would love to see somebody grow it, but I just don't think it's going to be me. I pretty much tried to do that with Moves the Needle, and we had a really nice growth run there for a while. But it's really tough with a services business. And so we were running experiments trying to figure out products that we could bring to market, but we never really found a fit for any. I don't think I succeeded with that part.
Well, isn't your accelerator a kind of product because it's sort of one to many?
It is, but it has to be inside of a company. Different companies won't come together to do that sort of thing. Maybe they will, but it's harder because
there might be confidentiality.
Exactly right. Intellectual property issues. And so that actually hurts the scaling because then you're just getting back to the mindset thing. So, we've done them for very large enterprises and they've been quite successful, but it's really a long slog to get them to go down that path. So maybe post next book, maybe there will be a demand for it.
Just to conclude then, which brand do you particularly admire, Brant, and why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I like Airbnb's brand. Uh-huh. And I think I like their whole story. You know, they had a horrible URL when they started, and their branding was, you know, their brand elements were pretty horrible. So their URL initially, I think, was air, bed, and breakfast all spelled out. That's like quite a bit to type. But their idea was pretty neat and how they got started pretty neat. And I won't go and repeat the whole story, but, it really was two or three people in an apartment that couldn't afford the apartment. And that's how they got started. And they eventually, their market segment were people who traveled for work who wanted to have a locals experience. And so I think that that's just a cool idea. And you can sort of track the evolution of their branding elements as they try to capture that ethos, as they try to capture that spirit. And then, you know, several years in, they went through this big, huge branding exercise and chose a logo. And it really was important to them at that point that all of those elements come together and represent that spirit and represent their journey and represent who they are. And I just think that that's a really neat way to end up developing a brand. It's about the relationship that they have with this specific aspirational market segment. And I think it's cool.
Yeah, I remember hearing about their bellow. It's all about belonging and so that everyone can feel that they belong.
Yes.
You know, even though they're staying with guests who are not employed by Airbnb. Yeah, it's very clever. Very good.
Right.
Good choice.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, Shireen. And, you know, if anybody wants to reach out to me, I'm Brant Cooper on all social media. And, you know, brant@brantcooper.com is my email. And I respond to any and everyone. Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah, bye.
Bye.
My guest next week is Catherine Lang-Klein, the co-founder of Portfolio Creative, a creative staffing firm headquartered in Columbus, Ohio. She spent more than 20 years in the creative industry as a designer for corporations and ad agencies, both as an employee and as a freelancer. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not join my newsletter to receive fortnightly updates giving more insights on aspects of brand creation and brand building? Just download my 7 costly mistakes with your business and brand and you'll be added. Details are in the show notes.